Gleam Care has fought for civil rights in Madison and the country for decades. The former head of the Madison Area Urban League, Gleam, is now fighting to establish preschools for kids through his One City project. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gleam Care. You are the
sunshine of my life. Welcome, everyone. This is Gleam Care with Perspectives. I'm back here Tuesday after taking 2 weeks off to go explore the world. The Western world of the United States of America. Took my sons on a long trip, 12 days to see schools and community development initiatives and other efforts around the country, while also seeing sites and visiting family and making it a pretty memorable trip for all of us. I needed to do it for one of the reasons that we're going to talk about here today, about the education of African-American children and the state of it in the United States. I feel like I'm always working uphill on this issue. Even though there's a lot of people who push uphill with you, the challenges seem to roll back down on you a lot harder and a lot faster than those of you that are pushing. So it is awesome to have two people on this show today who have been mentors, leaders, confidants, encouragers of mine for many, many years. I don't want to say how many because now I'm getting old. But Dr. Howard Fuller is on the phone with us, and Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings is in the studio with me right now. And we've had a lot of interest in this show from people. So I know there are a lot of folks out there listening. But let me first say why I wanted to do this show. And then I'm going to jump right into these questions so we use this hour wisely. State of education of black children in this country is a topic that we can't take our eyes off of. Right now, if we look at federally, nationally, the leadership that we have in the White House and the Congress, there have been very few discussions publicly about the quality of our public schools, about even vouchers and charter schools, even though people are afraid that people like Betsy DeVos are going to push those. And she may do that. But there hasn't been a lot of discourse nationally about that, not very publicly. Also within communities, we're all wrestling with development projects and we're dealing with issues related to the achievement gap. But we're talking about it in the context of test scores, not real educational opportunity that connects kids to pathways to success. And so I've become a little frustrated, even with all I've done over the last 20 plus years, going on 30. We aren't doing, in my opinion, justice for our children. And so I'm so thankful to have Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings and Dr. Fuller, Howard Fuller, on here with me today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, good welcome, Dr. Fuller. So I'm going to jump right into these questions, you all. Dr. Gloria Billings' name, she is well known, not just in education, but nationally. I'm going to start with you. But she is a professor, the Kellner Professor of Urban Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, plus a variety of other things that she does in our community here with Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority. She's been involved in numerous organizations, both locally and nationally, past president of the American Education Research Association, AERA. I got so many acronyms, about to mess them up. But Dr. Ladson Billings, start with this question for you first, and I'm going to get to the one about both of you. You focused a lot of your work on culturally relevant teaching, on the educational debt. What is the educational debt, and why is culturally relevant teaching important to us right now in the context of educating black children?
Okay, so I hope I can do this justice. I was actually in Brookfield last night talking to Wisconsin alumni, and I said to them that you probably will get no argument from people when you ask them, what's the problem in American education? In general, people will agree that the problem is disparate outcomes, that some kids seem to do okay and other kids struggle. That's the point of agreement. Where there is disagreement is why and what to do about it. So for why you're going to get everything from the parents don't care, the kids not ready, the schools are terrible, the teachers don't do. Everybody has a different why. And everybody has a different how. Put more money in public schooling, neighborhood schools, charter schools, vouchers. So we're all over the place with the how and the why to the question that we've all agreed is the issue, that there are disparate outcomes. I've really tried to focus on that part of the problem that I can in some ways exert some influence and control. So I can't change parents if you think parents are the problem. I actually don't seem to believe that, but mm-hmm. let's take it let's take it as a legitimate response. I don't think there's much I can do to change parents. The place where I can enter the conversation is in the classroom, what I call a point of service, the teacher standing in front of the kids. There are other people who have much more systemic influence, and so they can change whole systems. There are more people who do more policy-like work. So I've focused almost laser-like on this idea that the teacher in the classroom has some influence on the learning experience of the students sitting in front of them. And so I've been, for 25, 26 years, researching and writing about teachers who are successful with our kids. Why did I go success? Because the literature is replete with failure. Mm. We got all kinds of hypotheses about the failure, almost to the point where we're paralyzed and have essentially thrown up our hands and said nothing works. More money doesn't work. Longer school day doesn't work. Putting them in a uniform doesn't work. Making them...
Black kids just can't be educated.
Can't be educated. And so I've not accepted that and decided... Where can I focus my energy? So this notion of culturally relevant pedagogy is based on three propositions. One, that you have to have a laser-like focus on the academic achievement of kids, or more specifically, the student learning. The kids ought to learn something as a result of being in school, and you ought to be able to document this is what they've learned. The second is what I've called cultural competence, that kids come to school with culture, they come to school with a language, a history, customs, ways of knowing and being. And what we want to do is build off of that. You know, all of our cognitive psychologists say that learning happens as a result of prior knowledge. So they already know some things. How do we build off of that and help them develop cultural fluency, not only in what they already have, but in what might be considered a mainstream culture? And then finally, what I've called sociopolitical consciousness, or the so what factor. Why are we learning this? What difference does it make? I think those are the questions that kids carry with them all the time. What is the point of this? How does this connect with my everyday experience? When teachers are able to do all three of those, you begin to see, I think, powerful changes in the way in which kids think and operate and perform. And that's really what we want to happen. We want kids to believe in their own efficacy, and we need teachers in front of them who believe that they are capable of performing at high levels.
So Dr. Fuller, he is the founder of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. I'm going to say that one first, since I happen to be selected by this man to be its first president and CEO. Back in 2000, I believe it was. But he also is the creator and director of the Institute for the Transformation of Learning. And he also is the chair and past leader of his charter school in Milwaukee. Dr. Fuller, you have been doing this for a long time. And Dr. Lassen Billings here mentioned she takes an approach within the classroom. You have really had an approach around widespread systemic reform. Why have you chosen to focus on systemic reform in the form of choice, charters, and how do you see this benefiting Black children?
Well, first of all, Kaleem, I wanted to say, thanks for having me on, and it really is an honor, and I mean this, to be on with Gloria, because of all of the people out here, she's one of the people who I respect the most. You know, I did teach a course at Marquette when I first got here, and I used her book, Dreamkeepers, as like the text for the very reason that, you know, she laid out. And she also did an article. I'm pretty sure Gloria did this article on Brown that I really found very interesting because, you know, I have some similar views about, you know, how to look at the Brown decision. But so it really is an honor and a pleasure and a privilege for me to be on with her. I think the way I've tried to go about this is to fight for black empowerment from a governance and a systemic angle. Because I totally agree with what Gloria said that, you know, at the end of the day, what it is that's happening in classrooms and schools to our children is where the, quote, rubber meets the road. But the reality of it is the type of governance structures, you know, who has the power to control the flow and distribution of the money is an important factor to creating certain types of conditions so that the things that she talked about can actually happen in classrooms. And the concern that I continue to have, other than the opportunities that our children have, because, you know, people talk about the achievement gap, but what we also obviously need to talk about is the opportunity gap. And what does that mean for our kids and why does it exist? And so that since I am a supporter of education reform, I think it's incumbent on me as a black person to fight to make sure that black people are empowered or have power, I guess is a better way of putting it, in the process of reforming education. So whether it is having more black people operate high quality schools, having more black people in the leadership roles in the various advocacy organizations, whatever it is, what I believe over time is no matter what type of reform comes down the pike, black people are always disadvantaged in some way, or maybe a better way to put it, we don't ever have the level of power that we need to have to influence the direction of what it is that's happening to our children. And so, you know, we can all have disagreements, and we do on things like vouchers and charters and so forth. I actually am agnostic about that. I mean, I support traditional public schools. I support charter schools. I support opportunity scholarships. I support vouchers for low-income people. I support homeschooling. I support whatever it is that will give us an opportunity to be more powerful in determining what it is that's happening to our children. But the thing that I get from Gloria, and also when I read Lisa's work and some other people's work,
Lisa Delpit,
is that, yeah, we can fight about those things, but at the end of the day, the question is, how are our children treated in the classrooms that they're in the schools that they're in? And so I was reading this book by Paul Tough, his latest one, about helping our children succeed. And one of the things that the psychologists continue to say is that if you're going to have a great school for our children, they need to come into a place where they feel like they belong. They need to come into a place where they have some autonomy. And they need to come into a place that will make them competent. And so the things that Gloria talked about are to me the things that you need to have happen in order for those three conditions to take place in a school.
So we've been doing this now, you know, with charters and vouchers, and, you know, some will say we've been addressing the education reform issue among African American children since Brown versus Board of Education. You know, it's hard sometimes with all that's going on to point to what might be actually gaining some traction. When we come back from our short break here, I want to get into that with both of you and just see from your perspective, you guys are out there very global. What are you seeing that's working? And I know, Dr. Fuller, you are the CEO of Leadership Academy in Milwaukee. What are you trying that you're seeing that's working to give us some hope? We'll be back in a moment. This is Kaleem Kerr with Perspectives.
It takes two, baby. It takes two. make a dream come true.
MadisonTalks.com is the home of Madison's most creative talk radio. If you have a serious gift of gab, you have stories to share, political, social, or religious positions to express, contact Madison Talks to have your own 60-minute weekly podcast recorded and posted for the world to hear. Have a new book to promote? Madison Talks is the ideal place to promote it. Fly solo or line up guests for your weekly live talk session. When your 60-minute program is finished live streaming, it'll be posted as a podcast to MadisonTalks.com for listening 24/7. Take your message to the world with MadisonTalks.com. Call 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. That's 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. MadisonTalks.com. Looking for your creative commentary. You're listening to MadisonTalks.com, stimulating conversation on a variety of subjects and issues that matter. Share your questions, comments, or answers with us at 608-210-1667. Now here's your host on MadisonTalks.com.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Kaleem Kerr with Perspectives. I'm here with Dr. Howard Fuller and Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings, two heavyweights in education, but also, I say, just in life. You know, these folks, their work expands the boundaries of the schoolroom and the university classroom. They've touched so many of us in so many ways. It's a blessing to have them here and an honor as well, as Dr. Fuller said earlier. But Dr. Fuller, I want to ask you this question first. There's a lot that has been tried. There's a lot that has been done in education. I just had this conversation with someone earlier today over coffee where I made a comment that we have spent trillions of dollars on education. To believe that nothing works with black children or anyone else, we would have to admit that or acknowledge somehow, I think wrongly, that we have never been able to solve this problem. I think that there have been a lot of positive solutions, but they haven't necessarily gotten the full commitment or gained the traction that's necessary for us to see really strong results with our kids in mass. What's your opinion on that? You know, what do you see that's where you feel like we've gotten some traction or there are some areas of promise that we should be focused on?
Yeah, let me start out though, Clint, by saying, you know, we've been at this much longer than Brown. I mean, the reality of it is that black people have been trying to figure out how do we assure that we can get the type of education that we need to make sure that the liberation from slavery, actually we were able to get the type of education that we need to exercise freedom. In my opinion, that is still the battle that we are fighting. and that we can go through these different periods of history and look at what focus did we have at a certain moment. So at one point it might have been integration. Another point it was hiring teachers. I mean, so I look at this as I'm in a continuing struggle, one that actually started from the moment that they ripped us off of the African continent and brought us here as indentured servants. And later on, you know, decided to enslave us. And then, you know, once we fought for our liberation and recognized the importance of education to help us exercise freedom. So from my standpoint, I connect myself back to that sort of enduring struggle. Mm-hmm. And what I've found over the years, and Gloria would know a lot more about this than me, is that at different points in time, there's a lot of different strategies that people use that work. A lot of times in education, though, stuff that does work gets ignored for a variety of different reasons that are political more than they are educationally. So right now, for example, in our school, which is now Milwaukee Collegiate Academy, it used to be CEO Leadership Academy, our ninth graders come in reading, because we do maps scores for our ninth graders. Our MAP scores, the kids are coming in reading in like the 25th percentile. If you look at where they are as ninth grade in comparison to all other ninth graders in the United States of America who take MAP, our school is in the second percentile of schools that take MAP. But when you look at our growth rates, we're in the 95th percentile. So what's happening is our kids are coming in very, very low skill, coming in as ninth graders. We're using a personalized learning approach, which seems to be having some significant impact on growth rates. But what I would argue, and again, Gloria knows more about this than me, there's a number of different strategies that work, but you have to be committed to it, and you have to pursue it with fidelity, and you have to actually believe that our children are capable of learning if we give them the right help and support.
Dr. Gloria Lassenbillis, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think Howard, you know, really hit the nail on the head around the issue of our, you know, belief about the kids. We have tons of literature on teacher expectation. That's irrefutable, that what teachers believe about kids has a powerful impact on how they will perform. Just had a report came out, I think, within the last 2 weeks from Johns Hopkins that suggests that if our kids have just one black teacher between grades 3 and 5, our boys are likely to graduate from high school. Okay, that isn't rocket science. That's an engineering problem. Where do we need to make sure we have these black teachers? Mm-hmm. But why is that so? Well, it has to do with the willingness of these black teachers to persist with our kids, to not presume that kids are incapable and incompetent. And there are some things that are going on around the country. I'll be going to Tallahassee next month, second year in a row, to a conference that's called Black Brains Matter. And the people who are doing this are black physicians who say, you know what, we got to help people understand that our kids can learn. They have the cognitive equipment. But we are doing things, whether it is the nutrition, the housing situations they find themselves in, that is closing off their cognitive opportunities. So I'm excited because there's more people who are interested in more holistic approaches, not just what happens in the school, but what is happening nutritionally for kids. What's happening, you know all the research about early learning. What's happening early on? What's happening in the justice system? I don't know whether or not you've seen the video from Grand Rapids, Michigan, where these four tweens, somewhere between the ages of 10 and 14, these kids are coming from playing basketball. They are held under guns by the Grand Rapids police for 10 minutes because they were suspected of being in a fight. They had no weapons, and you can hear this baby crying in the background, please, Mr. Policeman, don't shoot me. Please don't shoot me. Now, they realize they made a mistake. They apologized to the parents, but these kids are traumatized. How do you go to school if you see a policeman on the corner when you know you've been held for 10 minutes, and 10 minutes is a long time.
That's a long time.
With a gun on you. Two adult men. So our kids find themselves in an environment in which nobody trusts them, nobody believes them, no one has confidence in them. And the truth of the matter is, if you actually look at progress, year-to-year progress, it's not like our kids are not improving. The problem is everybody's improving. Mm-hmm. Our graduation rates, yes, they are higher. But the problem is many of our kids are not graduating the traditional way. They're not graduating coming across a stage at a four-year comprehensive high school. They're GED and HSED. Mm-hmm. They're testing their way out of high school. But the other thing is they're testing their way out of high school into an economic environment that has no place for them. Mm-hmm. My father had a third-grade education. He always had two, sometimes three jobs. We owned our own home. A person like my father in today's economy is a homeless person. So part of the challenge is that we are putting our kids in an economic environment in which they can't survive. I saw an article yesterday that said if you had a low six-figure income in the San Francisco Bay Area, you're considered low income. Low six-figure.
Yeah.
So the fact that our kids are struggling, it's not just that they're struggling in school, they're struggling with whatever we're doing in schools, not preparing them for a world they have to face. The last thing I'll say is I've been watching a school now for 20 years in the San Francisco Bay Area, Eastside College Prep, which has now a rate of 100% graduation and 100% admission and college going into four-year colleges. A group of teachers who believe the kids are capable, who start all ninth graders off with physics, who offer the kids two curriculum choices, college prep and college prep advanced. Because when you're 14, you don't have sense enough to make a curriculum decision. Mm-hmm. You just don't have the skill to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't have people, adults around you who can make those decisions, you're probably going to make the wrong decision. The difference that has happened in Eastside is they started out as a high school, but they realized their kids came in, as Howard described the kids at his program, with so many skill deficiencies that they needed to back up. So now they have a middle school. So the middle school, high school, and they have a boarding program. One of the things that excites me about what they're doing is they're not just focusing on getting individual kids academic proficiency. Now part of their program requires some community give back. They said, you just can't come and take. You have to figure out how you're going to go back into the community and help other people. So every year they have this wonderful ceremony where the kids, they videotape it, you can see it online, where the kids all discuss what school they got admitted to. And 90% of these kids are the first in their family to ever go to college.
You know, this begs a question, too, about what kind of schools we need, because you all have borne witness to my struggles as I've watched yours, and trying to get people to see that the type of schools we have are not enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that we're not working hard or we're not trying, but if we think that an AVID program, for example, is going to be the answer for children who come from challenging backgrounds, not insurmountable backgrounds, just greater challenges, you know, they don't have a place to sleep. Or a reliable place to sleep. They don't have a reliable place to do homework. They have parents, two parents maybe even going two different jobs at night. I know a lot of people like that where they're not able to put a handle on their children. And because the village is broken around them, there's no grandma or grandpa or someone like that because they're working now too.
Right.
You know, so if we don't provide those holistic, robust environments for our children, my belief is we won't be able to be successful, and I see it in my own school with helping families get jobs and helping people access, you know, I lost my housing. All right, well, we'll make some food for you with our cook, and we'll get you set up at a local organization, Porch Light or something like that, so we can intervene so that there's not a lot of break in support and stability for the child.
Right.
What do you all see? How do we make that happen? I mean, how do we convince people in our communities? We have donors, we have policymakers. Oftentimes people with their ideology, they stand in the way of doing these things that we all need. It's just that because these kids don't have it, some of us argue we got to use the systems to do it.
Right. Well, early in the school year, I was in Dayton, Ohio. And Dayton had just completed something that is sort of a parallel to what Race to Equity was here in Madison in terms of reporting on the disparity. Their program, however, was focused very specifically on education, and it's called Learn to Earn. And at the end of my presentation, it was philanthropists, there were state legislators there were educators, administrators, a broad cross-section of the Dayton community. And someone asked me a question about, well, what one thing? Because everybody wants a magic bullet, you know. What one thing? And I looked the guy square in the face. I said, a job. I said, a job makes all the difference. I said, because if I got a job paying a living wage, now I got someplace to live. If I have somewhere to live, I also have some food to put on the table. I got food to put on the table. I have actually some time to sit with the kid, my kid. It's like, you know, a set of dominoes.
Mm-hmm.
So what has happened in this country and Madison, Milwaukee in particular, is people don't have jobs. So they have to try to take care of themselves. They often try to take care of themselves in, quote, illegal ways. The men are incarcerated. The women then are evicted. You have a whole system falling down on kids, and schools are not equipped to deal with this.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Fuller, what are you seeing down there? I mean, you live in such a historical place, because I remember reading in Ebony Magazine in 1970 that Milwaukee, for about 3 years in a row, you remember when they used to name the best place for black people in the U.S.? Milwaukee was the best place for black people in the U.S. And I didn't believe it, because I grew up in the context of the 80s and the 90s. And so I went back and looked at the data. And sure enough, in that community, there was a 3% gap between black and white men in the labor force in 1970. 76% of white men were working, 73% of black men. White men had an average 12th grade education. Black men had an average 10th grade education. So you think about the industries and everything that left, and the jobs that we could walk into, they'd take us if we were a college dropout, because we had values, we had skills. But now our schools are trying to address these issues. What do you see, Milwaukee, with the holistic nature? Are you able to get any traction on that there, of addressing these broader issues with kids?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, the way I look at this, Glenn, is we have to walk this tightrope between saying, because kids are poor, don't have the resources that they need, they can't be educated. But on the other hand, there are people who will try to act as if the fact that people don't have health care, people don't have the economic circumstances that they need to provide for kids, they try to act like that doesn't make a difference. Both of those things are untrue, right? It does make a difference, man. Like, in Milwaukee right now, there are 27,000 households that have a household income of less than $10,000. And that's not even broken down by race. There's like 20,000 between $10,000 and $14,900. So,
wow.
What I'm trying to say is that, like Gloria, if someone asks me, well, what is the most important thing, education policy or economic policy? I'll say economic policy. Because I think if you can pursue certain economic policies that give people living wages, that give them the possibility of having resources, that's going to have a much greater impact, actually, on schools than a certain type of curriculum would. That's not to say that curriculum is not going to have impact, but if kids can come to school having been fed, other things that they need have been taken care of, you're going to have a much better chance of giving them a great education. It's not to say they can't get a great education when they come without those things, but it makes getting a great education so much more difficult. And more, I've been pushing the idea that, yes, you can create great schools, but it's hard to create great schools in communities that are a disaster. Because kids don't live in schools. They live in families. They live in communities. And so what I've concluded, actually, is that, number one, in spite of all of the rhetoric that people have, our children are really not viewed as our most valuable gift from God. That all of the stuff that we talk about, how important our children are, everybody talking about the kids, when you look at public policy, when you look at the things that would impact the kids' lives, there is no political will in this country to do the things that would make a significant difference for our children. There's rhetoric every now and then, but there is no real political will. And so what happens is educators are put in the position of trying to deal in ways that they've never been able, been trained to deal with. So, for example, if I had my way, there would be a trauma center in every single high school and middle school in this city, and maybe even in elementary schools, because you know, our kids are under so much stress. They come to school already at a level 5 on the trauma scale.
Yeah.
And most educators have not been trained to teach kids who have that level of trauma walking in the door. So I know what I'm saying sounds pessimistic, and it is because I am pessimistic. It isn't that I don't believe that our children have great resiliency, because they prove it every day. Mm-hmm. There are kids who are being successful in environments that they have no right to be successful in. You know, but they're doing this in spite of the lack of support that they're getting from the body politic or from the society at large. And so I don't personally see any place where people have said without equivocation, we're going to do whatever it is that's necessary to make sure that our children not just get a good education, but that our children's lives are transformed. And a good education is only one part of that.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not committed to all of these other things, it just makes it difficult for the good education to, A, happen, and then even when it happens, it sometimes doesn't matter, because there's no place for you even after you get this great education.
Mm-hmm.
So but after saying all of that, I still feel you have to get up every day and fight for our children. Even when we're not going to all agree, but I respect people who may disagree with me on tactics and this and that, but at least they're getting up every day and fight. And it's like, and I'll end with this, it's like what Derek Bell talked about
mm-hmm.
in his book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well.
Yeah.
So Derek was making the point that I actually agree with, that racism is like permanent in mm-hmm. American society, right? So if racism is permanent in American society, then the argument is then why do anything? I mean, you can't come to a good result. And what Derek says, and what I agree with, is that you have to get up and fight, even if victory is not imminent, because not to fight is to co-sign on the injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how I feel every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually would say there's another part in that book in which Derek's words are something like, just because something is impossible doesn't mean it's not worth fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy or the things that I've looked at with that is, our ancestors were fighting slavery. It was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody said, you know what, I'm getting up tomorrow and fight this thing. You know, I know I got to get up and pick this cotton, but I'm still going
right.
to fight this thing.
That's right.
My own parent, my grandparents were sharecroppers. That was a system that was impossible. It was rigged. There was no way to get ahead in the sharecropping system. But somebody still said, you know what, I'm going to fight this thing in some kind of way. My grandfather saw the Pennsylvania Railroad and said, you know what, I bet if I get on that train, there's something else on the other side. Can't be worse than what this is.
Mm-hmm.
My own parents grew up in legal apartheid, state-sanctioned segregation. My mother couldn't try on a hat in a downtown department store in Philadelphia. It didn't mean that she didn't fight against that. That, I mean, that was the law, she couldn't do that. So it frustrates me when we make the biggest problem that we have educating kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who have come before us have taken on insurmountable,
huge challenges.
And I believe every generation has its task. And I think this is ours.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can pass it off to anybody else. I don't think we can expect somebody else to do it for us. I think we must do it. And we're not called to be successful. We're called to struggle. I mean, that's literally what we're called to do. And it's at odds with American worldview, because Americans believe they're supposed to be successful. No, you're supposed to get out there and work for something and struggle. I remember as a kid growing up in Philly, you'd see brothers coming home from work, and my father might holler, "Hey, how's it going? What you doing?" And he'd be, "I said, out here working, brother." That's what you just did. And I think in my trips to Africa, what was eye-opening for me is that people were working at stuff. They weren't making much money, but it was like, we out here working. That's part of what we've lost, this desire to continue to fight in the face of what looks like defeat.
Yeah, you know, I think about when I drive through Milwaukee, I've driven through Philly, you go through those areas, and more so you see it in Milwaukee than in Philly, those boarded up communities. And you wonder, what are children thinking when they're at school and the great teacher in front of them, too, is telling them, but you can still be anything. But yet, they walk outside their door and they see boarded up buildings surrounded by things that look so nice. And Dr. Gloria Lentz-Millions, you and I had this conversation right before we started about my experience in D.C. where I was there with these young men playing basketball or football with them when I was with Target Corporation. And one of them asked, we stopped one of them. We asked them if they could do anything or wanted to, you know, go anywhere. What would it be? He said he wanted to see the Washington Monument, but he lived in Washington, D.C. And he walked us to the fence and pointed to it. He had never been there. When I asked the teacher, she said, because he's been bad. They don't take back. I mean, just crazy stuff like that. That's holding our kids back. When we come back, I got one more question about black educators. And then we're going to take some phone calls from you all. You can call us at 608-210-1667, 608-210-1667. If you're trying to find the number, it's at madisontalks.com. This is Kaleem Kerr with Perspectives. We'll be right back.
MadisonTalks.com is the home of Madison's most creative talk radio. If you have a serious gift of gab, you have stories to share, political, social, or religious positions to express, contact Madison Talks to have your own 60-minute weekly podcast recorded and posted for the world to hear. Have a new book to promote? Madison Talks is the ideal place to promote it. Fly solo or line up guests for your weekly live talk session. When your 60-minute program is finished live streaming, it'll be posted as a podcast to MadisonTalks.com for listening 24/7. Take your message to the world with MadisonTalks.com. Call 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. That's 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. MadisonTalks.com, looking for your creative commentary. You're listening to MadisonTalks.com, stimulating conversation on a variety of subjects and issues that matter. Share your questions, comments, or answers with us at 608-210-1667. Now here's your host on MadisonTalks.com.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Kaleem Kerr with Perspectives. I'm sitting here with Dr. Gloria Lentz-Millions in studio and Dr. Howard Fuller on the phone. We are talking about the education of African-American children in this country, what's done, what can be done, what the issues are to address the educational outcomes of our children, which in mass haven't been too great, not as great as we want them to be. But first, I'll say if anyone wants to call into the show to ask them a question, you can do so by dialing 608-210-1667, 608-210-1667. If you're somewhere else, you can also dial the toll-free number, 844-346-4824, and you can find those numbers at MadisonTalks.com. We have a challenge of educators, too, and I'm feeling it in my preschool that I'm doing. We have a fairly diverse group of teachers right now, but people ask me, Kaleem, what are your greatest challenges? Because they want to know. They want to know, how can I help? And they always think, because we're a nonprofit, oh, it's just going to be money. I'm like, money's always the issue. It doesn't matter if it's for-profit or nonprofit. But my concern is, as we grow and want to tackle this issue more broadly, where are our teachers going to come from? Because there's a decline in the number of young people who are choosing teaching as a profession. And anytime you see that, you know you're also going to get a decline in those most talented young people who are choosing this profession as well. So not only are we losing talent at the bottom with the drain of the pipeline from K to 12, with not enough talented children making it out of high school into college to become those educators, those that are going aren't choosing education. You know, what are you all seeing with that? And how do you, any tips or thoughts you have about how we address that?
Well, I think you're right when you identify that we have a pipeline problem. If you don't graduate from high school, it's very unlikely you're going to become anybody's teacher. Mm-hmm. So we got that issue. Then we have the second issue of, if I make it into college, there's so many other things I could do that are more lucrative, less stressful, more prestigious. And our students are making those choices. We saw that's one of the downsides of sort of the modern civil rights movement, that instead of being pigeonholed into nursing and teaching, and for black men, preaching, people can go to business school, then go to law school, and now go to med school, go into chemical engineering. There's so many other opportunities for them. So that's a challenge. How you combat that challenge is that you have to do some things that make teaching more attractive. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that you improve the working conditions and certainly the remuneration. People will come to something that pays off, you know, for mm-hmm. them. So I think that's a systemic challenge. We see here in the state of Wisconsin that there's teacher shortages everywhere, not just Milwaukee, Racine, Madison, Beloit, but, you know, River Falls and Eau Claire. I mean, people are looking for teachers because it's not that attractive a profession anymore. So that's a systemic problem, but it's felt acutely in our communities.
And Dr. Fuller, you have Milwaukee Collegiate Academy, and you are trying to, you know, I'm sure, recruit teachers every year amidst a number of schools, public, private, and charter that are trying to do the same thing. You know, how challenging is this down there, and how are you all seeking to address it?
Well, I can't add much to what Gloria said. I mean, it's a math problem, Kaleem. I mean, there's a data point that says that for first-generation students who go to college, after 6 years, only 11% of them are graduating. That's not even broken down by race.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a math problem because you start out with the number of black young people who graduate from high school, the number then that get accepted into college, the number that go to college, the number that ultimately complete college, mm-hmm. and then the number who, after they complete college, they want to go into teaching. This is a monumental problem. And then if you're down in Atlanta, trying to talk to some young black person about coming to teach in Milwaukee? I mean, Milwaukee? where is Milwaukee? Yeah. Is that the place where it's 20 below? I mean, when you start looking at all of the factors that you're facing, it's a very, very difficult thing to confront. And then there's the other side of this, and is I was reading this book by Michelle Foster, and it's called Black Teachers on Teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did was she interviewed these three groups of teachers. I think she called them elders, veterans, and novices. Mm-hmm. And one of the elders was a woman who had been teaching for 60 years down in South Carolina. But they were talking to these teachers about basically what happened when integration came. And when integration came, three things happened. Black schools were closed, black teachers lost their jobs, and black teachers' opinions were devalued. When ed reform came, three things happened. Black schools were closed, black teachers lost their jobs, and black teachers' opinions were devalued. So not only do you have the systemic math problem, I'm calling it, you also have this other problem of what happens to black teachers when they get into teaching? What happens when various reforms come down the pipe? What is the impact of those reforms on black teachers? So we have some monumental problems to overcome. And I have to be honest, at this moment, I don't see the systemic practice that are going to address some of these fundamental issues.
But we do see, for example, other countries who don't have this particular problem. Mm-hmm. So we always have these invidious comparisons between the U.S. and Finland. If we prepared teachers like Finland, we would have people begging to be teachers. Because first of all, they look at the best performing high school students. and then say to them, you might be smart enough to be a teacher. And because we think you might be smart enough, we're willing to pay for your entire college education through the master's degree.
Think about that.
So they don't even accept applications anymore because they got too many people who want to be teachers. So it's a mindset that emanates from, you know, from the national level about who teachers are and the degree to which we have any responsibility to respect them and to choose them from our best and brightest. We go the other way. We say, well, you're not smart enough to go be a physicist, but you know what? You could be a physics teacher.
So, you know, my question, too, is, you know, I know, Dr. Fuller, you and I have some familiarity with Betsy DeVos, who is now our Secretary of Education. You know, I got in trouble on Facebook because I told people that I think she should be respected but not confirmed. That's my own opinion. But it was because knowing her, she's not, I don't think she's a racist. I've never seen that part of her. She's invested a lot in the education of black children. If you support her issue of private school vouchers and charter schools, but there's a whole lot more that the Secretary of Education has to take on. This is an area that I have a big question about is, will our Department of Education take on the issue of the lack of teachers available to teach overall in our country schools, and definitely the limited supply of teachers of color teaching in these schools? And it is a pipeline thing, so that we can't address one without the other. You know, do you all see any room for opportunity for our Department of Education to address that, given that we don't really hear anything about policy coming out of Department of Education yet at all?
Yeah, you know, you and I have had a similar experience with Betsy. I've taken a lot of flack for supporting Betsy, and it really doesn't, I'm not even mad at people for being mad at me, you know, because, you know, I understand, and I can only function based on what I know. But having said that, forget Betsy for a moment. Go back and look at the last six secretaries of education. And how have they tried to address the issues that we're talking about? And one of the realities is the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education, provides maybe 14% of the funding that goes into elementary and secondary education in this country. Because the reality of it is that in this country, education is still fundamentally a state function. Mm-hmm. And I honestly don't know what significant role the federal government can play in addressing the issue that we're talking about, but I would think that whatever it is, it would start with money. It would start with putting aside the kind of money that Gloria was talking about to enhance a reason for people going into teaching. But you have to have a mindset that this is an important thing to do. I mean, it's not a direct analogy, Colleen, but I always find it interesting when people tell me that you can't end poverty by throwing money at it. Actually, that is the way to end poverty, is by throwing money at it. And there's actually research out there that shows that cash-oriented programs actually lift people out of poverty. And so it's the same thing. We can't talk about things that we need in this country, and in order to actually implement them, you have to put resources into it. You can't say we care about this, but we're not going to raise any taxes. In fact, we're going to cut taxes. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to put all this money into the Department of Defense, blah, 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 blah. And then at the same time, we're going to try to address some of these issues. It's not going to happen. And so that's why it's clear to me that we don't have the political will to do some of the things that we could do to at least help the problem, as Gloria was outlining.
So, and I would also say that, you know, talk about political will. I've been in education almost 50 years. I became a teacher because the federal government said, if you do this for 10 years in an urban school, we'll pay back all your student loans. I'm like, you got a deal. You got a deal. And it was what's now become the Pell Grant, which was formerly the National Direct Student Loan, was the NDEA, the National Defense Education Act. I was going to be a teacher in defense of the nation.
Wow.
That's how it was framed. So if we think about teaching as a public service and ask ourselves, what public service should every citizen do? Well, some of them are going to do their public service in the Army, in the Armed Forces. But why wouldn't teaching be a primary public service?
Ooh. I love that.
You know, why wouldn't I get a better mortgage rate because I'm a teacher?
You know what? We need to start pushing for that tomorrow. You know, I do. I worry about it so much. You know, that tell people, it keeps me up at night because you have to be good at what you do. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Finland is choosing the best and brightest and giving them the support to go through, I don't have a problem with that.
Right.
And I feel like if our children knew in the beginning of their education that that opportunity was going to be there at the end of it, more of them would persist. But I want to thank you all for joining me on this show. It will be available on podcast in about 5 minutes after this show.
Okay.
We have a great sound technician here. A radio technician who takes care of that for us. But I'm on this show with Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings of the University of Wisconsin and Dr. Howard Fuller of Marquette University. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. It's been an honor for you all to do this. I know a lot of people are going to listen to this podcast. If you have questions, you can hit me up at my Facebook page. Just go to Colleen Care on Facebook and you'll find it. I have a public page, so it won't have a hard time getting on it. This is Kaleem Carroll Perspectives. I'm signing off. Next week, I'll have some women from our community, three Latina women, to talk about their experiences growing up. We're going to shatter the myth that everybody who came here came across the border yesterday. These women are actually done a lot in this community. We want people to understand what they think about Madison. I think people will be surprised. This is Kaleem Carroll Perspectives. You all have a good day.
All right.